Hello and welcome to another episode of Hub Team, a new podcast for a new politics. And this time again, we have another episode in English. Our apologies. We will try to subtitle it in German to make it accessible for everybody. But we have a great guest from the United States. We have exciting news about Tiffany Caban. So please welcome Charles Lenchner, who is the co-founder of People for Bernie, all the way from New York. Hi, Charles.
Hello there. Hi.
Yeah, well, great that you could be here. So 2 days ago in the morning, my Twitter suddenly exploded with Tiffany Caban. And shame on me, but I'm in Germany. I had never heard of Tiffany Caban. Who is Tiffany Caban? Why does Tiffany Caban matter?
Well, I'm going to try and do this the right way and say that the for district attorney in the borough of Queens, which is also a county, which is part of the city of New York, and the district attorney office is a state office. There's lots of district attorneys, and they are the ones who set policy for prosecution, for making decisions about where to put resources when it comes to enforcing the law. So normally they're considered to be very close partners of the New York Police Department or whichever police department is near you in figuring out, you know, how to allocate resources to maintain law and order. And of course there's a lot more to be said on that, but I want to take a step back and help explain why this particular race for this particular office is suddenly exploding everywhere, why it's such a big deal. And it's going to take just 1 minute for our foreign friends to get with the program.
Go for it.
Okay. So as many of you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez won an election not that long ago.
Yay!
That's right. She is a young woman. Sorry, not that young. You know, she's perfectly qualified and old enough, in case anyone asks.
But not relatively old enough to run for president.
Not old enough to run for president. But she comes from a working class background. She's a woman of color. She was part of the Bernie Sanders, you know, momentum of folks pushing politics to the left here in the U.S. She comes out of a group of Justice Democrats and Brand New Congress that had very high ambitions, and she was their first really big win in terms of winning a seat and having influence. But since she was elected, on the one hand, she's continued to be a superstar, using social media in ways that make every other politician, you know, jealous and drool with envy. And on the other hand, there is an argument that could be made that her victory was a fluke. She caught the established forces inside the Democratic Party in Queens by surprise. She came out of nowhere. She had a ragtag army of Democratic socialists and others, you know, who sort of mobilized to door knock. And they didn't have as much money. They didn't have institutional support. They didn't have the backing of unions. All the things that normally predict who wins elections in New York City in general, but in Queens in particular, were absent for her. And she won anyway. And she defeated a man, Crowley, who was also the head of the Queens Democratic Party. Now, parties here are a little bit different than in Europe. You know, saying the Democratic Party is almost always a misleading way to phrase it. But in New York, in Queens, there's a machine made up of lots of interests who find a way to work together. And that machine values loyalty and consistency. They want to know that the system works and works regularly. And many of the actors, including progressive actors, would rather settle for a guaranteed, you know, small gift down the road than a maybe huge gift down the road. So in that sense, she came in owing no one any favors. She is not part of the institutionalized political system that exists in New York.
And perhaps by way of background, we should mention that Queens, New York, is overwhelmingly Democratic. So whoever is the Democratic candidate will win the election. So we essentially have a kind of one-party state. And the democratic process takes place in the pre-selection of who's going
That's
to be the
right.
candidate.
And That's
Crowley
right.
had been the man in Congress for years and years and years and years, you know, right up there in the sort of inner circle with Hillary Clinton and all that.
That's right. And there's another component here, which is primary elections tend to have low turnout, especially when they're not the every 4 years presidential election. So elections, you know, to even get to a 10% voter turnout is a big deal in an election like we just had with Tiffany Caban. So these low turnout elections mean that if you have a small number of people who are highly motivated and you can, you know, order them to turn out and they just will, you've got something really valuable that can only be defeated if tons of people suddenly decide to take such a strong interest in politics that they run around voting, which is contrary to what people normally do in their day-to-day lives. So that AOC versus Crowley race sets the stage. So the question can be asked quite legitimately, was this a fluke? Is this real? Is there something that AOC unleashed or revealed, or that the organizations behind her victory, whether it's Justice Democrats or the Democratic Socialists of America, did they do something that is going to stick around? Are they really setting a new game of politics in Queens and in New York and in the, or are they going to be sent back to having small meetings of people who are never going to influence anything? Well, as recently as 5 months ago, she wasn't a candidate. And it may seem like 5 months is an enormous stretch of time, but Tiffany Caban. Right. Yeah. For a race like this, that's almost no time at all. I mean, her opponent was going to run and was scheduled to win long before 5 months ago. So she assembled, or she was in touch with various people and had a crew that was backing her and encouraging her to run. And when I say crew, and I want to be careful here, I might sound less sure of things than I would be otherwise, because I don't want to make a mistake and have it be forever on this podcast. But when we're talking about how these things happen, it's often a kitchen table with some friends who may belong to various organizations. A lot of those people probably to a bunch of organizations. Among the ones that we could count in this instance would be the Democratic Socialists of America, which just in the last year expanded from 7,000 to 14,000 members in New York City, it's already past the Trump wave that we got. It continues to grow. It's kind of amazing. You also have groups like the Working Families Party, which has been around for much longer and has a much better grasp of the traditional political mechanisms. Until not that long ago, the Working Families Party was incorporated into the machinery of how normal machine politics worked in New York City. To be sure, on the left, to be sure, standing with unions. But they have a lot of people that sort of know where the bodies are buried and how to pull the right strings. But they've moved to the left in the last chunk of time since the Bernie Sanders race and a little bit before. And that meant that you not only had this grassroots army waiting to be mobilized, but you also had the expertise and the connections to run a campaign in an efficient, effective way. And I'll add this other piece. Since Trump was elected, the entire progressive forces, and I'll use the word progressive to mean anything to the left of Donald Trump, has been revitalized. People feel this urgency to engage in politics as if it really mattered. And while a big chunk of it really was motivated by the election of Donald Trump, it doesn't mean that the energy doesn't get used in primaries. It doesn't, I might have become more politically active because Trump was elected. That doesn't mean I'm going to stand aside when there's a fight in New York State over the composition of our legislature and where my main enemies are Democrats who are not very good and I want to replace them. Nothing to do with Trump, but the energy is still there. One of those groups in New York, I just want to mention this really quickly, was formed to oppose some Democrats in the state Senate who were working with Republicans, some sort of bad Democrats. They were being all centristy and flip-floppy, and we really didn't like them. So a group came seemingly out of nowhere and was like, let's get rid of all these people. And they did. They elected, I think, 6 out of 8 seats flipped from IDC members to non-IDC members in New York State. This is huge. This is unprecedented. The amount of change created is hard to convey. And we just finished the legislature session, and a whole bunch of amazing new initiatives were passed. Protecting women's reproductive rights, protecting renters from being abused by their landlords, budgets for a Green New Deal, just like the wish list. Now people are saying, what do we want now? There's too many lines crossed out on the, we need more. we need new demands for stuff. Help.
So this is great. So we've got the situation because let's say I'm a member, not so long-suffering member, but of a very long-suffering party, the SPD, which has been essentially captured by an institutionalized careerist core and has essentially lost its electorate. It's lost its popular support. It's just seen as a sort of technocratic party that doesn't really know what it stands for. It's now at something like 12% in the polls. But to simply know that all these people coming into politics who want change, that they can get involved and actually, okay, you've got to work out what the rule books are. You've got to work out, you know, how you stand, how you build a campaign. But the people who maybe just a couple of years ago were a bit angry about things, they're now professionalized, they're organized. They, you know, they helped do the Bernie campaign back in 2016. They got experience, and they are now, they're a new machine, but they're a lean machine and not a machine that's based on this sort of, oh, well, basically nobody comes to meetings so we can pass whatever kind of shit we want. They are a machine that actually has a vision and ideals, and people are not in it for the money or for some kind of professional career,
right,
but to change society.
Yes. And I want to illustrate this with some of the specifics. So, you know, the DSA, which I've just bragged about as being this huge, large organization, you know, any day now it's a one-party city. But no, but it's still a relatively small, weak organization as politics goes. We don't have a huge war chest. There's no, you know, headquarters building with staff. Like, that's not how it works. It's mostly volunteers. And the volunteers have been spending the last couple of years, and I want to point out, everything is in little groups. There's an electoral commission for the city. And what they do is they figure out not how do we intervene in every race, how do we award an endorsement, you know, because we love AOC. They pick strategically when and where to intervene because they want to have the impact of everyone sort of congregating together on that one point where they can make a difference against the establishment. And because this race was a special election, special because the previous DA was not going to run again. He had fallen sick, resigned, and I think, I'm trying to remember if he died or not, but it doesn't matter anymore. A special election means that there's no competition for like other races taking place. There's no other big seats to fill. So I'm going to give you some numbers now. They were able to knock on something like 120,000 doors, and that is
frankly incredible. How many members? 14,000 members in New York.
Well, to be clear, volunteers came from many orgs, many progressives. There were people coming from outside the city, driving an hour and a half to help volunteer for this race. It was attracting lots of people who are inspired, because if you give people a chance to do something meaningful, it makes you want to do it. Whereas most elections where the stakes are low, and even if the right person wins, not much will happen, that's very different. And I'm going to explain why in this race in particular, real things can happen. And I'm going to turn to a topic that will be fun and exciting for all of us. And that is the topic of sex work. So the U.S. left has broadly adopted the stance that individuals who are part of the sex industry are sex workers. They deserve to have their rights as workers and not to be harassed by the carceral state. Remember that term as a quiz later. Carceral state meaning the part of the state that wants to arrest you and, you know, give you fines and punishments and maybe lock you up. If you support workers, you have to support the rights of sex workers to not be locked up, to not be harassed by the police. You want them to feel that the law enforcement mechanisms are there to protect them, not to oppress them. This is a position that a few years ago, people would have said, why are you talking about this? It's so out there in terms of most of the mainstream or sort of mainstream daily newspaper type opinion. It's just really out there. But in recent years, as a result of a law that Congress passed that made life much more difficult for sex workers across the country, the community of sex workers sort of has come together. They have various organizations. They are initiatives that they're behind. But they really didn't have any elected partners. There weren't politicians clamoring to embrace this community and say, we care about your issue. We see you as constituents. Now, in Brooklyn, you had another DSA member who ran for office, Julia Salazar. Julia Salazar and AOC were openly meeting with sex workers, having closed door convenings where they listened to what their concerns were and incorporated them in. They were canvassing with sex workers in these elections. Now, Julia Salazar and AOC, because of where they are, actually have a lot less impact on the lives of sex workers, because in Congress and in the state legislature, there isn't another law that's about to drop that will transform anyone's, you know, lives in that way. But the Queens District Attorney has the power to tell the prosecutors, we're just not prosecuting sex workers for these crimes, X, Y, and Z. We're not going to send the police to round them up. We're not going to arrest you because we found you with condoms in your purse. We are, you know, there's going to be a shift in mindset from seeing these people as hazards that have to be controlled and contained and forced out of public view to protect all the normies. Instead, they're going to be seen as people who ought to have rights and dignity and ought to be treated as, you know, fully entitled consumers of our society, of our law enforcement system, not as the victims of it. And the ability of Tiffany Caban to change people's lives in that way. Remember, the most vulnerable populations in the United States, you'd have to put women of color, trans women of color engaging in the sex trade. That is, that, I mean, if you'd be hard pressed to find a group of people that enjoy fewer protections in our society than this group. So by taking this group and elevating their concerns in the way that Tiffany Caban has done, and I'm not claiming it's her signature issue, it's one of many, but it helps to articulate why this is so revolutionary, why winning this seat, putting a good person in the role of prosecutor, it will change people's lives and it will radiate outwards. It will show other people in other parts of the country, you can do this too.
And it seems
I'm talking for too long.
No, it's great. We got you on the show because we want to hear you. But that a politician to sit down next to sex workers, say, you know, trans sex workers of color, you know, that is kind of what the established Hillary Clinton party would never do. You know, there were armies
never.
Of people whose job it was to prevent that photo ever being taken. And so for someone to really go out and say, I'm not just here for, you know, this hypothetical middle ground, but I'm here for the weakest, most vulnerable in society.
That's right.
And I had a look at sort of Tiffany's amazing series of promises, and it's not just that, but for instance, use of recreational drugs, that she simply will not prosecute that. And perhaps it's worth in this context talking about what people have called the prison industrial complex, that you have a huge, you know, a great corporate business now of running prisons. You know, it's a machine that demands to be fed. Prisoners are a commercial commodity. And you have an extremely racialized justice system where, and I don't know if this is still true, but I read at one point, young black men, young Afro-American men are more likely to be in jail than in college, which is just mind-blowing.
I probably should point out, in New York City specifically, I'm not sure about the existence of for-profit lockups.
Okay.
That is a major issue. I don't want to leave the impression that that was a non-election issue. Yeah.
Right. But, you know, she's really talking about protecting the community. So she wants to go after, you know, she talks about the 6% who commit 60% of the crimes, but not about people who are committing misdemeanors, which are essentially not harming other people, but also maybe going after prosecuting things like bad landlords, people who steal people's wages, prosecuting ICE officials, immigration officials who are harassing people illegally.
Well, I think this goes to, this entire conversation is probably going to drive certain anti-state anarchists a little bit batty, because the left historically has had this position that, you know, well, the power structure and the police and the courts and the prisons, all that stuff is bad. And we're going to be on the, as far away from that as possible, you know, lobbing brickbats at them, you know, those bad people, they want to lock up people. But in this case, we're putting one of our own in the role of an enforcer, in the role of someone who's making decisions about who should be charged, what sentences should be pursued, you know, what is the point of the justice system in a particular part of the country. And it's moving, it's evolving, and this is backed by what people seem to want, from one focused on retribution and punishment to one that is sincerely asking the question, how do we reduce crime? How do we help people? How do we How do we foster a feeling of safety and dignity for as many people as possible, rather than looking at sort of the wealthy or the middle class neighborhood saying, you're the model, everyone else needs to be like you. And if you're too much not like that, we're going to come down on you and send some cops around to, you know, make sure it all comes out right. We're changing that. And it remains to be seen, of course, what kind of pressures are brought to bear. For sure, the opposition has plans for how to prevent things that they really don't want. But it's an exciting moment. And I think that this challenge the left is facing now is not how do we win elections. Got that. How do we win elections again when they're ready for us? Oh, we did that too. Now it's going to be shit. Now we're in charge. We own it now. We better not fuck it up. I mean, just as an example, if crime goes up in the next 4 years in Queens, that's going to be bad.
Sure. and definitely there will be people who are already sharpening their pencils. And
that's right.
You know, to come in for it. How important do you feel then the grassroots movement is? Because there's always this temptation of kind of, hey, we won, so now we can go back and relax and go back to TV or whatever. But we've already now, you know, these great expectations have been released that suddenly people are dreaming so much bigger.
Yes.
How do the grassroots engage to keep it a sort of a dialogue between the movement and the elected official and not just kind of over to you now?
Right. So one thing to understand is, you know, one of the ways in which our political system functions is that you have political parties, you know, you have Democrats in particular areas, but those institutions are like sponges that are most of the time dry and empty and not exciting. And, you know, the only fun stuff that's happening inside of them are often illegal and involve money going to the wrong people. But then when an election comes, they fill up with energy as volunteers, you know, come in and money pours in and they are captured by the candidates. So during a presidential year, like 2020, the political parties at the state level are going to be turned into vehicles for electing the Democratic nominee. And anything else that might have been going on becomes subsumed to supporting Obama, supporting Clinton, support, you know, whatever. As you go down the levels, that remains true. If it's a federal seat in Congress or for Congress, then the local Democratic Party in that area is going to be all about electing that, you know, that Democrat. The reason they function that way is because everyone's getting paid. Yes, there are volunteers, but it's a system that runs on enormous amounts of money and patronage is pretty ugly and that we as leftists have very little to do with. But a group like DSA or like the WFP function differently. They never had as much patronage to offer. They will never have as much money. They don't have as many staff dependent on this sort of up and down swing on elections. But what they do have is large numbers of people that if you ask them for something important enough, they will come out and volunteer. So I would say that there's a permanent advantage to these volunteer forces because when the race is over, they don't go back home and say, all right, we're going to wait for the next thing. Instead, they go to meetings about how could we have done better? They go to meetings to, you know, let's say you trained 100 people to become canvas leaders. Well, now you've got 500 people who want to be canvas leaders. Well, you've trained people and use phone-based tools for recording data from your door knocking. Well, some people figured out how to do a better one. The AOC campaign gave birth to a new software on your phone that helps make the door knocking easier to record and to work with, increasing efficiency. That energy and enthusiasm is spreading. And that goes back to the doubling of DSA's membership in the last year. Like, because people see that it actually works and makes a difference, especially against the background of low turnout elections. The entire power structure is a paper tiger, Steve. They're just not that strong. All it took was a bunch of us to get together. We can blow them over. How exciting is that?
Well, it's very exciting, and it's a perspective. I think this perspective of power is something that maybe in the UK and in the US is now really there, and it kind of changes everything in a way that my experience in Germany is there's this latent aggression towards, you know, the police and the justice system for very good reasons. Looking at the American justice system and just the amount of firearms deaths at the hands of police officers, you know, the incredible racial bias in those deaths and how few.
Do tell us from Germany about our racial bias. Please continue.
No, but the German police are bad, but it's important to keep some sense of perspective there. But just as perspective, hey, what if you had a genuine leftist and they could run for office and change that? That is a perspective that actually the German left has fragmented and atomized, is
right,
completely forgotten. And so then anybody is like, oh, well, if you want to be a candidate, you're kind of selling out, simply because they don't actually believe. And it's more like, oh, sour grapes, I could never get that. So we're going to do something much better, which is we're going to have our little reading group. And whereas here, what you're describing, all these volunteers coming together, is what the Rules for Revolutionaries book, the Becky Bond book about the Bernie.
Yes.
The big ask, you know, suddenly it's the radical demands that get people out of their armchairs and say, yeah, hey, if you're going to really change that, if you're going to have healthcare for everybody, then I want to come and campaign for that. And these sort of middling, lukewarm, middle of the road demands, no one cares about that. No one's going to I'm going to go out there because I think we need a little bit of this, but not too much. And we should also take care of corporate interests. Who cares? I'm not going to volunteer for that. It's the radical demands which actually create your volunteer army. And that's certainly a perspective that I really hope we can take home.
We have things worth fighting for, finally. And I would also say this is where, you know, for years, I and many others would sort of complain, the U.S. System of first past the post. You only have two candidates for the big elections. Only one of them can win, as opposed to proportional representation, where each large enough segment in society gets to have its own party that more or less represents what that constituency feels. You have a choice at election time that will probably result in at least someone getting elected that you sort of like, which is not true in the U.S. I mean, if you only have two choices, most of the time it's not, you know, you're not really happy with either of them. But the other side of the coin is that our system breeds a kind of widespread apathy. We have these low turnout elections, especially when it's a non-presidential year. So you end up with a system where the establishment relies on people not being involved. And year after year, they lower expectations and make it seem more ridiculous to demand things. But once that dam is broken, and there's a sense that now things can change, that same system facilitates a rapid turnover. Because if the number of people turning out to vote is only 5 or 10%, well, let's do the numbers. So how many people do you need to turn out? I think that Tiffany Caban is going to win this race in an area that has millions of people with 40,000 votes, more or less. 40,000 votes. That's just not that many people. And I've already talked about how many doors were knocked. Like, these are doable tasks. And I would also say that we are relatively unburdened by hard fossilized faction fights on the left, where you have lots of people who within the left only care about, you know, one particular way of doing things, or, you know, one thing over there. There's much more of a new exciting spirit to all this that hasn't hardened into, you know, people who think that I'm trying to come up with a good far left position. People who think that if we participate in the state, then we own it and we're no better than anyone else. Like, we don't have weird factions like that with that anyone takes seriously. We just have people who are saying, this is exciting. Where do I sign up?
Wow. Okay. Well, that is perspective. Just to round up, do you want to just tell us briefly, what is People for Bernie?
Yes.
Who's going to win the Democratic nomination for the president?
I'll wait for that.
We'll come to that last. So what is People for Bernie?
In 2015, People for Bernie came together as an outside support group for the Bernie Sanders campaign. Now, this was at a time when he had lower name recognition. His campaign didn't exist yet, didn't have staff, didn't have a website that could hold events and so on. So we used social media and other techniques to amplify his message, recruit people, and mobilize them in ways that the regular political structure couldn't really account for. I'll confess that this time around, because Bernie Sanders did so well last time, he doesn't need our help in the same way that he once did. But we still exist as a crew. We still have a page on Facebook with 1.5 million. We still have connections that let us participate in politics in ways that feel useful so far. Like we can provide national attention on candidates in smaller races, which we've done a lot of. But I was when I was talking to you about this earlier, I wanted you were sort of trying to figure out, is it an organization? Have we deployed resources in the Tiffany Caban race or whatever? Not exactly. We actually have no organizational status. There's no bank account. There's no legal status. We're just a collection of assets and email addresses. But we do have an innovative model that we'd like to export. And that is a political entity that has no meetings, no decisions, no budgets, no one to pay, no staff. And once you've figured out how to do that, you can get an enormous amount of things done because it liberated the crew that behind very many people. But by hiding behind a keyboard, by using social media, we were able to have, you know, this exciting influence on the system and to be seen widely as a good actor doing important work without a lot of the nonsense that would plague a more traditional organization. And when I think about the big flaw of the left in every continent, which is too many evenings, I just want to propose that the People for Bernie model solves that. We actually consume no evenings because we don't have meetings and you can't join us.
Okay. I think we'll have to do a separate episode on that because it sounds so paradisical and yet slightly paradoxical as well.
Yeah.
But the evenings question is definitely a question. So last question, is Bernie Sanders going to win the presidential nomination?
I'm not going to give an answer to that question on the record. That could hurt me in the future. But I will say that I believe that the combined forces of Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have a very good chance of passing the 50% threshold for both of them combined when it comes to the next Democratic convention. While many will focus on the differences between these two candidates, when you consider where we were 4 years ago, the fact that both of them are in the leading pack of candidates who might win, it's amazing. I mean, what was the recent thing? Not that long ago, Elizabeth Warren came out with a proposal to spend $1.25 trillion doing something about student debt. And, you know, it was a plan. It's a good plan. But then a few weeks later, Bernie Sanders comes out and he's like, no. We're going to spend $1.6 trillion. We're going to get rid of all the debt. What kind of competition is this? How do you top that? Where do you go from here? Of course, we have to win the elections, but I just think that instead of worrying about who wins, we should be worrying about how to make sure that every rhetorical gain on the political map, every advance that the society is taking to the left, how do we solidify that? How do we avoid fucking it up by fighting with each other?
Well, that is certainly something that we can spend a lot of time thinking about. Charles, thank you very, very much. And thank you so much also for the whole People for Bernie campaign. I think when Bernie started out, he was this unknown senator, this weird guy who was independent from Vermont, 1% name recognition.
And now he's Daddy Bernie.
And yeah, but you have completely dominated the political landscape and you've given, you know, a whole country you know, the power to dream of what we could actually do politically and taking it out of the hands of this machine based on just this sort of decrepit, death-like desperation that no one actually comes
to. Right.
And people banging on doors can really change stuff. So it's very exciting. We look forward to hearing more about Tiffany Caban, what she does.
I can't wait to hear. I want to hear this podcast dubbed in German. Thank you.
We don't dub it, but we're kind of hoping to subtitle. But guys, if there are anybody out there sort of has long evenings who are free because they've got a free organization and they've got their evenings free and want to transcribe and do subtitles for these videos, we'd be extremely grateful for your help. We think that there's a lot of stuff happening in the English-speaking world that's definitely of interest to us here in Germany. So, Charles, thank you so much for coming along.
Thank you, Steve. That was another
episode of Hub Team. If you like us, tell your friends, give us a great review on iTunes and all of that because it helps spread the word, and that way other people get to know about it as well. Our music, as always, is by Yannick Plumer. And if you want to let us know, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, I think on Instagram, or just send us a mail at contact2ks@hubscene.fm. That's the end of the show. Bye.